Welcome to Cultural Icons. Gordon McLaughlin, welcome to you. Gordon, people in their own minds have a kind of view of, not really a generation, but what sort of cohort they belong. It's usually a bunch of people they grew up with or went through their kind of early adult years with. It kind of formed their view of the world. Who would you say was yours?
Well, I went to 8 primary schools. I left Dunedin when I was just a boy. I think I was 8 at the time, the day that the Second World War was declared. So I went to 8 primary schools. It's a bit of a blur. And until I went to Wellington College for 5 years, I didn't really have any close friends. It's what turned me into such a dedicated reader. I spent a lot of my time reading. At Wellington College, I was good at sport, and I grew up with a group of people who had been born before the war, before the baby boomers. And I think we're quite a distinctive group, the people who actually grew up during the Depression and the war, from the baby boomers who came afterwards. And I think that shaped my life quite a lot.
Who would be recognised from that group, that chief stuff?
Well, I have a few friends. Some of them are dead, of course.
We all have few friends. The older we get, the fewer we have.
And there are a few. I keep in touch with two or three of them. And I went to an old boys' reunion a little while ago, last year actually, and I ran into some of them I hadn't met for 40 years. And the interesting thing is they basically turned out the way I had thought they would when they were, except for one. They were basically the same sort of people. And I think it's a very distinctive group of people brought up at a certain time.
Yes, so we can get a kind of grip, though, of what you saw, your New Zealand or New Zealand that time being. Are there any of these people who have done stuff similar to you, any writers there or any poets or artists or people that we might kind of recognise in terms of shaping our views of their time?
Interestingly, no. There were a lot of academics. A lot of them became academics. A lot of them were in different parts of the world. One of the friends I had at Wellington College now is an academic in Melbourne. Others I tracked. Most of them, strangely enough, became scientists of some sort. And to some degree, probably a less obvious degree, they probably did shape New Zealand life. But no, I am the only one who is probably well known, nationally known.
Gordon, you mentioned that you were good at sport. Can we just fiddle away with that for a moment? Because, you know, you don't strike me as a kind of sporting person. You're kind about sportsmen, but you don't strike me as somebody who's a dedicated follower of this or that code, are you?
Yes, I was good at rugby. I was too small to be in the first 15, but I was in the second division, and I was in the top team in the second division, and we went, my last year there, we went through without any defeats at all. We were the clearly superior Wellington team in that division. I was also an extremely good boxer. And I think going to 8 primary schools helped that a lot. You wake up every morning. And in those days, kids fought a lot more than they do now. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot. They talk about bullying in schools. Bullying was rife in schools when I was a kid. And every day I would wake up, or every few weeks I would wake up and be at a new school and think, oh, God, here we go. I'm going to have to fight somebody today or look as if I'm dangerous. I was only a little wee guy, of course. So by the time I got to Wellington College, I was a really accomplished boxer. I won my weight, I think, every year but one. Afterwards, I fought in the town hall in Wellington for a while. And I went home to my mother one day when I was about 17, and I said to her, you know, there's a bit of money to be made as a professional boxer. And she looked at me and said, are you mad? I forgot that. I said, well, no. She said, don't even think about it. And that was the end of that. So I never...
Well, I can see the roots of that in your somewhat pugnacious style, but when did you actually think that writing might be something that you would do? You said you read a lot, but people read a lot and don't become writers, don't want to actually contribute to what they read. When did that occur to you, that might be something that would become a more of a vocation than a career?
Well, I think it was very early on. My father was a journalist, and two of his brothers were journalists. It was deeply ingrained in the family, and I was brought up in country newspapers. My father would move from one country newspaper to another, thinking the next one might be better than this one, I think. He was a bit peripatetic. So I was always around the smell of ink and the smell of newspapers. And my father didn't want me to be a journalist. He wanted me to be an academic of some sort. And I spent 1 year at Victoria University, and I got bored terribly. I was terribly bored with university. And so at the end of the first year, I got terms, but I never sat the exams. I got an opportunity to go into the Southern Cross newspaper as a copy holder at night. And I never really stopped. From there on, I became a journalist. And my father was also a very literate man. He read a lot. He introduced me to writers like Frank Sargeson when I was still a kid. We had books in the house. I was reading Dickens. Interestingly enough, there were very few, if any, children's books written by New Zealanders at that time. Mm-hmm. The only children's books were imported from England, and they seemed to me to be totally irrelevant to my life. But Dickens wasn't, and I remember reading adult books from quite a young age, mainly because they were in the house. Also, we, like a lot of New Zealand families, wherever we went, every Friday or Thursday, or whenever it was, we went round to the local bookseller or the newsagent, and Mum would get a copy of Champion, which is a magazine for boys, Girls Crystal from her sister.
Didn't Champion Listener have Rockfist Rogan in it?
That's right, Rockfist Rogan. She would get the Listener, Truth, and the Daily Mirror from England and those yellow covers. I was one of the few kids that I can remember where the parents didn't mind if we read Truth. I mean, it was always lying around the house like everybody else. And other families, they told me that the family, the mother and father, would hide it because it was full of sexual innuendo.
Well, it wasn't quite so much. It had a bit of that, but it was a crusading paper at that time. I mean, because we think of Truth as just a couple of pin-ups holding apart adult advertisements, we forget that paper really had a long... My father, by the way, was a freelance photographer for Truth, I found out many years later. It did have a history of being a crusading, especially in World War One, it crusaded against that war. It was a left-wing crusading paper.
Yeah. Well, even when I was working as a journalist, I worked in Napier for a few years on the Daily Telegraph as a senior reporter and a rugby reporter, I might add, and as a sub later on. But interestingly enough, the family that owned the daily paper were in a bit of a... They had a relationship with a couple of developers in the town, including the mayor, Tate. And we knew something that was going on. And this happened right around New Zealand. So what we did is we wrote for Truth.
Yeah,
and it was virtually a firing offence. And they used to send it to you in your payment in a brown and plain brown envelope to your paper. And so in fact, there was a commission of inquiry that resulted from this land deal that was entirely inspired by me and another guy writing for Truth.
Wow, yeah.
So it was a very, very useful publication.
Yeah, it was, and pity we don't have publications as useful as that now, given that the same kind of practices continue in city councils around the country. Just putting that aside for a moment, though, the business about being a journalist and starting as a copy holder, that was kind of very interesting evolution. It was copy holder, proofreader, cadet, and you go down on your bike to the train and pick up the shipping news or whatever, and then you get some jobs, and then you became a reporter and a senior reporter and a sub-editor. Did you actually follow that, or did you just jump straight from copyholding to writing stuff?
I went pretty well as a copyholder. Interestingly enough, I received an email the other day from a journalist in Australia. My father, in his last 10 years of his career, until he was well into his 70s, was deputy chief reader of the Evening Post. And this man sent me, he was a career journalist out of Australia, and he'd gone there in 1965, and he sent me a note, I don't know how I found out my address, saying how much he owed to my father. He held copy with him for 6 months, and he said he knew everything, and he was a grammarian of some school, and he said he was so useful, and he said, young journalists do not get exposed to that sort of thing nowadays. And I've been collecting solecisms from the Herald for some years, for the last, say, 10 years. And I feel sorry for these guys. I mean, they make egregious mistakes. You read it under their name and you think, oh, God. Now, they would have been saved by two people. They would have been saved by an experienced sub, and if he didn't save them, an experienced proofreader would.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, they don't have that. I came across my favourite, all-time favourite mixed metaphor the other day, which I got from the Herald. I won't name the guy. I probably will sometime. He was talking about a Black Caps batsman who was probably going to lose his job. He was losing form and they thought he'd get rid of him. And he described it in the most condensed and brilliant mixed metaphor I've ever heard. He said, the ticking of the clock must be ringing loudly in his ears. Now, when I was a young journalist, if I'd written that, it would have not only been corrected, the original would be pinned up on the notice board I would have been laughed at for a week. A very good way of curing bad habits.
Yes, well, I was a copyholder and proofreader and a revised proofreader on the Christchurch Press, and I remember a terrible mistake I made in spelling the name of the doctor in charge of Edmund Hillary's expedition to the South Pole on the front page, and it was I was the only one there. They did in those days what they called climbed up in the stone and hammered it. So it was Dr. Blur Blur in the West Coast edition. Anyway, I just, not my reminiscence, but just going back to that notion of being a grammarian and having that kind of experience of the language, I've often wondered why you were so in are so intolerant of the apostrophe.
Well, I think it's a pretty useless thing. Only the possessive apostrophe. I mean, not there are a lot of apostrophes that function well in the language, but I made a challenge to a publisher a couple of years ago to present me the sentence where the apostrophe was critical that I couldn't change and do without the apostrophe. Most people are totally confused by it. It doesn't really function. The English language of the last 200 years have been getting rid of cases, and the possessive case doesn't matter anymore. And 99 times out of 100, where the apostrophe is doesn't matter either. So I keep betting people that, you know, after the end of this decade it will go. But some people insist on it. Mm. It reminds me of a saying by Robert Conquest. He said, people are reactionary on things they know about. And the grammarians want to keep they know about it, and it's part of their knowledge, and they're proud of it, and they're very reluctant to let it go. The woman who wrote that book, I can't think of her name at the moment, about apostrophes and grammar a little while ago, I met her at the Christchurch airport one day and told her I thought that the book was an act of grammarian neurosis. She laughed, actually, thought it was funny as well, but the apostrophe is doomed.
Well, I always thought it was wonderful irony that, you know, on the cover of your own autobiography, a life's sentence, there is the apostrophe, the possessive, what's more.
Well, I
did you not argue with your editor about that?
I still use it because I know where to put it apart from anything else. Mm. Sometimes, like the subjunctive, I deliberately don't use a subjunctive because it doesn't matter anymore. Yeah, it's an utterly meaningless piece of grammar that doesn't matter at all.
For those who don't, you might explain what it is.
Well, it's if I were king, the element of doubt, and that's a simple explanation of it, really. And I don't want to know about it because I don't think it matters at all. But some people try and preserve those sorts of things for the sake of preserving them.
You know, Gordon, you did what now more modern journalists do as a matter of course, but for you it must have been rather unusual to what some of us consider to be crossing to the dark side. You moved from journalism into, well, it's now called PR or spin doctoring, but you were an early adopter of that particular role. Who did you work for?
I started working for Air New Zealand. I left freelancing. Before I became a freelancer, I actually worked full-time very briefly for Air New Zealand and realised that I simply wasn't cut out for corporate PR. I didn't like the idea. I remember talking to one of the very senior management people one day about telling lies, and I said there are more ways of telling lies than denying something or affirming something, that you can do it by innuendo. And he went pale when I was talking to him. So I thought, I can't handle this. So then I went freelancing as a journalist and as a writer, and I wrote a couple of early books, which don't make you a lot of money, but I was working for the National Business Review and doing work for the Herald. And I was asked once or twice to help out with publicity for airlines, and I didn't mind doing it on contract because I had control of it. I could do what I wanted to do. I could leave but I had very good people I worked with. I worked for Pan Am for about 10 years, and then they pulled out. Then I worked for United, and then after I'd been at United a little while, I went and worked for Continental Airlines.
Continental pulled out. You've got a bad record with airlines.
None of them made any money while I was working for them either. But it got me around the world several times. Mm. I did do work as a crisis public relations officer for Deloitte for some time, and I really enjoyed that. If they had a client with a major communications problem, I would go in and help them out. I actually wrote a book out as a result of one of those.
What was that?
It was the Northland Dairy Company. Oh, they had a problem with. Interestingly enough, I sided on completely I came out deeply on the side of the journalists involved, and the company said, well, I explained it to them, and they said, yes, I see that. So I acted as, the way a PR should function, and that is trying to get people to see the truth and the sense.
And respond to yes. it in a yeah. kind of an appropriate way.
That's right.
And not just to, well, actually, this brings me to another point. You also worked for DB, didn't you? Or was it?
Yes, DB? I did. I had a year's contract with Sir Henry Callaghan, one of the funniest years of my life, actually. I met with him every Monday morning, and I found that his staff, the senior staff, were very sycophantic. And that's not in my nature to be sycophantic, as you know. So I used to say things to Henry, that I could hear the management drawing their breath in. And he always regarded it as quite amusing. And so for a year, I sort of talked to him. And I honestly never did anything I suggested. I mean, he talked to me and he smiled and he said, yes, that's a very good point. And then he didn't do it. And at the end of a year, I was paid well and I had a free car. And at the end of the year, he said, Gordon, we have to talk about your contract. He's quite a character, Sir Henry. And I said, Sir Henry, look, I don't think I can keep doing this. And he's like, what? And I said, well, you don't take any notice of what I say. I think I give you good advice about handling the public and the presentation of the company to the public, but you never take any notice of me. I don't find that very satisfying, so I think I'm going to sack you. And he thought that was enormously funny. But, you know, can't we come to someone? I said, no, Henry, it's Sir Henry. It's just not satisfying for me. So I fired him very amicably.
Yes, we have a housekeeper like that. But let me use that to segue to another issue on the sort of the same subject about the current DB campaign, which has been potted by the Broadcasting Standards Authority about the rewriting of history. Because you're passionate about that, I just wonder if you'd just kind of give us the background of that and your anger about it, and then we'll go on to this business about dealing with history, which I think is one of your, I think it's one of the things that drive you, Gordon.
Yes, I first read the print version of the advertisement and I was horrified. Then I saw the television commercial and I was even more horrified.
Just explain for the
The structure of it was this, that Morton Cooch, who I knew quite well, who was a brewer at Dominion Breweries, was well under, the company was run by Sir Henry, but Morton Cooch invented a continuous fermentation system which enabled brewers to keep making not in batches, etc., etc., etc. But after the 1958 budget, Nordmeyer, as you know, increased the tax on beer.
By a penny or two.
Yeah, yep. But it annoyed a lot of people. But the thrust of this advertisement was that he had put a tax on imported beers. There was virtually no imported beer in New Zealand at the time. The tax that affected people was on the locally made beer. That was the first thing. Secondly, they said that Morton Cooch owned Waitemata Brewery, which he didn't. It had been a listed company for years. Then they showed riot scenes, which hinted that in 1958 people took to the streets. The whole thing was just a complete fabrication of... I could go on and on about the errors in it. And I was so incensed by this that I emailed the PR people at Dominion Breweries, the head of PR, and she came back with the most marvellous answer. She said, talk to me about something else. And she said, we were amazed by the response. People were talking about the advertisement the whole time and let it go. Off it went like that. And so they kept putting the advertisement in. They kept playing it endlessly while the cricket was on. But she had not, what she'd done, their masterly PR cynical thing. You can't, if you can't answer a question, pretend you didn't hear it.
Yep.
And so it went on for weeks, and I thought it was an act of great cynicism. And they decided, I tried to explain to them that, to people that they described Nordmeyer as a Puritan bore. Now that's a matter of opinion, they can say that if they like. Morton Cooch, I knew, was actually a bigger bore than Nordmeyer would ever be. Nordmeyer, you could say he was a Puritan, you could never say he was a bore. But anyway, I tried to explain the difference between having an opinion on something and telling a fib about something. Yeah. And that was the telling of lies in that advertisement that really, really irritated me.
Yeah.
So anyway, we killed it, but not till they'd played it to death.
I mean, I just think that business of rewriting history for cynical reasons is actually something close to a crime. And I think you feel that too. I mean, history has been one of the things that, I was going to say that you've clung to, but it's one of the things that you've actually been, you've insisted on, is a driver of who and what we are, and it maintains our integrity. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, and you're quite right. You can have opinions about history. You can have your opinion about what events, how events occurred, how they were resolved, and what they meant to us. But you can't distort those events themselves. And that's the critical thing to me about that advertisement, or about anybody who tries to take history and make it something else, tries to take events and make them something else. My attitude towards my youth and what happened during my youth, I know people that shared my youth would have a different point of view on it, but they can't deny the facts of what happened.
No, exactly.
That's critical to it to me.
You're passionate about history, and your best known book is a book about the rest of us not being passionate about anything.
Well, yes, it's
passionless people. How did you come to write that? What pushed you down that track?
Well, I was really, people think I did it as a matter of a whim. I actually wrote it in 6 weeks over a summer when I was 40 odd and I could work at a huge pace because I'd been a journalist for a long time. What made me do it was, since the time I was a child, I'd travel around New Zealand. I knew New Zealand very, very well. Then when I was, after I left the Daily Telegraph, I worked in Wellington for 5 years as the Wellington correspondent of the New Zealand Weekly News. And during that period, and I was also working for the Journal of Agriculture, which Wilson and Horton were publishing at the time, during that period I travelled widely. I went to almost every town in New Zealand. There were parts of the South Island I didn't go to because of Les Bloxham, who was the South Island correspondent. He was mainly a photographer. But every second Monday morning, I would get in the car and I'd drive to some part of New Zealand. I virtually assigned myself to these jobs. And I saw New Zealand as a country. I'd lived in small towns when I was a kid. I'd lived in cities. And I saw what was happening. And I was appalled by the kind of boring, awful country we'd become. My favourite was that we actually had an egg entitlement board. Before you could start a poultry farm in New Zealand, you had to make sure that somebody else had closed one. And the egg marketing board decided how many eggs would be produced. And I mean, I'm no free laissez-faire capitalist by any means, but this kind of constriction was like Russia, you know. I mean, it was kind of benign Russia. And this happened all over the place. And the place also, the country was also run, and people don't realise it, to an extraordinary degree by conservative farmers. They had taken control of New Zealand in many ways.
Yes, you better point out here the nature of the government, because people will just be assuming that this was a government given to controls, but all of our governments have been given to controls.
If people don't realise that in 1949, when the Labour government went out and the National government came in under Sid Holland, that was supposed to be a free enterprise government, well, if you read back to the election campaign, you can find that Sid Holland was trying to outdo the Labour government on their welfare packages. I mean, I'm in favour of welfare and properly applied, but there were these kind of constrictions that were clamped on New Zealand, and there was the town-country divide. So anyhow, I felt I was qualified to write that book because I was so widely travelled in New Zealand. I knew farmers, I knew newspaper men, I knew city people, I knew small-town people. So I suddenly thought one day I'm going to do something about this. And a lot of people forget, you know, when I was growing up and became to manhood, almost there was a uniform. Men wore grey trousers and tweed sports coats. Very few people actually wore suits. And if I'd worn a pair of purple trousers or a highly coloured green sweater or something, I'd have thought I was some sort of weirdo. Mm. We were very, very controlled by ourselves. Mm. Not by a nasty government.
Gordon, it's a generation later, has the Egg Entitlement Board vanished?
Yes, the Egg Entitlement Board has vanished so far that you now get rotten eggs. I'll say one thing about the Egg Entitlement Board and the Egg Marketing Board, you never got a rotten egg.
Well, I should rephrase that. Has it vanished? Because it's now obviously a metaphor for something equally bad. I mean, the notion that we will be saved by committee.
Oh, yes.
What's our little ambition when we arrive at the gates of hell, Gordon, you and I?
Yes, if we're asked that to choose between boiling oil and an unending committee meeting, we shoot for the boiling oil, yes. In fact, in the Passionless People, people have forgotten this. In 1976, I had a whole chapter on called Passionless Proceedings, and it was about committee meetings. And I remember saying that if you got three Germans together, you would get an army. If you got three Russians, you get a dissent. I can't remember what they were now. If you got three New Zealanders that have a meeting, have a quorum and pass a remit of some sort. It's even worse. It's a kind of disease. And it's kind of underground now.
Now it is. Well, I don't know if it's underground. I think it's just so ubiquitous we hardly notice it. Like the wall, it's there.
I don't know. That's true. I spoke to a teacher a little while ago who has three meetings a week. I would have thought that a school would have had a meeting on Monday morning and about what they're going to do for the week, lasting about a half an hour. And that's another thing. Meetings go on endlessly because they're not controlled properly either. In my time, when I was younger, meetings were controlled by people who were arrogant and hammered a gavel. Now they're kind of they think it's democratic to let people talk on endlessly. It's a huge... the process and it replaces the action.
Yes, a committee without end.
Oh, it's a huge knock on productivity.
You know, just to say something about that here, when I first started work, my first real job, apart from the little jobs that had newspapers and stuff, was at the Auckland Art Gallery, and I was there for 12 years. And those 12 years were pretty critical in that gallery and in the kind of visual arts scene. But in that 12 years, I don't remember a single meeting about anything.
Well, it's also an abrogation of responsibility. What happens is, you see, somebody's got a job to do. He's got something he's responsible for. He thinks, what if I make a mistake? I'll form a committee. I'll get the committee in. And then it spreads the blame. People are afraid of the kind of responsibility they should be taking. There's a wonderful story by a friend of mine who, I won't say who he is or what organisation he belongs to, but he got utterly sick of meetings all week. They'd have three or four meetings. And they were asked one Monday if they would offer items for the agenda for the meeting they had on Friday. So he put on it, no more meetings, please. And he said it's the only thing that didn't make the agenda. It is a serious problem in New Zealand. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a businessman who said that the process is becoming seriously prejudicing action in the business.
Yeah. The process has become the point. The objective is to have the process, but not to actually work the process.
It's a substitute for action.
It's a substitute for decision. It makes me mad. I know it makes you mad, but you're rewriting the passionist people. Will we notice, in your view of ourselves, any measurable improvement in these behaviours?
I think in many ways it's worse. Because it's, to me, it's a little bit more insidious now. It doesn't seem to be as obvious to me. When I was writing that book, I think New Zealanders were sick of committees, and they seem to have gone underground. I mean, I got a huge response from that chapter from a lot of people.
You won't, because everybody's on one.
Well, that's right. But it seems to me to be more insidious now. It seems to be working its way right. The Resource Management Act, to me, was pretty nearly a flawless act. But it was destroyed by the process. And that's a classic example of it to me. Here's a perfectly satisfactory piece of legislation destroyed by the process. And so what do? They start amending the legislation instead of adjusting the process. Yep. It's a serious problem for New Zealand society, I think.
Yeah, it's very hard to see, and I'd ask your advice on this as a younger man, Gordon, only just, how you might begin to unravel this. I mean, you and I know, because we have lunch every week, rail against it, but how do you unravel it? I mean, it gets worse, not better.
It's very difficult to do, because I don't know how to unravel it unless you suddenly... The best way would be to build a language against it. Make committees a bad word, like they've made liberals
like key performance indicators and outlaw language like key performance indicators and going forward and working through the issues.
Yes, I think you have to use language to destroy it and make all those words bad words, like they've made liberal a bad word in America and socialist and all those things. They're perfectly functional words, but you can't use them in an argument or a discussion anymore because they're certainly outlawed. I think we should try and outlaw the word committee. It will take brave people in organisations to do away with it. And they are the people who would say, we're going to disband the committee next week on footpaths, and you, Cyril, are going to be in charge of footpaths, and you report to me every third Friday for half an hour and tell me how you're going. It'll take that kind of attitude, I think.
Yeah.
People really taking responsibility and making other people take responsibility.
You know, this notion, this political conceit that the first 100 days in office is critical and everything done then will reflect on the entire administration. I noticed that Auckland's new mayor in a new city, amongst those 100 things on his 100 days that he listed, there were numerous committees, but nowhere did it say what they did or what their objectives were. Mm. So the idea of setting up a committee has become a substitute for an objective.
Mm.
It's actually, well, I've got a committee so something might come out of it.
I think really that this is pervasive. It's right through New Zealand life, and it's it is a distorting function in New Zealand life. I don't know how you get rid of it. I have long thought it's not going to happen because it would be political difficult. I have thought we should have a language commissioner, just like we've had a privacy commissioner, just like we have people who are economic commissioners, you know, the Treasury, have a language commissioner who can pull people up when they start. Every time I have had...
Not a language committeer.
No. A commissioner.
That's what it would turn out to be.
I always think of Phil Goff. Phil Goff calls things inappropriate. Well, and I can imagine if an invading army landed on the shores of Northland and were moving down the North Island, Phil would be saying, this is totally inappropriate behaviour. I mean, it is within the range of moderately bad to totally awful as inappropriate.
Well, actually, Gordon, they could amass outside Wellington and throw agendas at the advancing army. That would hold them up.
Yeah, have a committee meeting across the road and block their progress. I think the language is appalling in New Zealand. The political language is really appalling, and then nobody's ever held to account for it. Helen Clark probably was the best Prime Minister for a long time, but hers deteriorated during her last term in office. But the first term, two terms in office, you basically knew what she was talking about. She basically used simple words. It's got bad again. John Key doesn't seem to have any facility for language at all. He doesn't seem to be able to express anything in an individual way. His language is very bland. So anyway, it's not going to happen because politicians will not allow it to happen.
You know, let's just get back to the point about language. I mean, language like art, like anything that consists of a whole lot of behaviours and things that do, is seen sadly now as an end in itself. Do you think that language has become captured by process as well? In fact, that saying something is more important than what this something said means.
And also not saying it in a brusque and sensible, intelligible way. One tends to fudge. Politicians, of course, are past masters at fudge in language. But yes, it has become part. I listened to a guy from Waitakere on television recently explaining a leak. And he was reciting a piece of answer he'd learnt, and it was quite clear. He said it twice, and the interviewer on television didn't have enough sense to say, "Now look, yes, that's the rehearsed part. Now let's talk about what's really happening." So this guy just went on saying these few words. They get away with it seriously in New Zealand. Yeah, it's not good. It's not good.
It was an English Prime Minister said there are lies. Damn lies,
yes.
And statistics. Well, we chat about lies, damn lies, and going forward while checking key performance indicators.
Yes, but statistics are another thing that I see on television many times. Most reporters, most journalists, of course, are enumerate. That's a starting point. And in fact, a few years ago, apparently the School of Journalism in Auckland tried to get a mathematician in to explain, you know, the use of statistics and other mathematical formula for journalists. Quite often you hear somebody on television, and sometimes in print as well, saying that something has happened and it's 19% worse than it was last year. They don't tell you what it was last year, or they talk about somebody going for a wage increase of 2%. Now, a wage increase of 2% on $2 million a year is a substantial amount of money. On $2 a week, it's nothing. Yeah. And they do not use the base for statistics. So, yeah, statistics is another form of lying. It certainly is.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, but when it moves into language, like the use of the word decimate, when, you know, somebody fell over and they were decimated.
Yes.
Not 1 in 10.
Yes.
Gordon, your own career, if you had to nominate a book you most enjoyed writing, a book that you really got the most pleasure out of, not the most reward, what would it be?
A Short History of New Zealand, which has sold very well. I brought it up to date, which I think was a bit of a mistake in a way. You should let history...
eat your books, that's a good plan.
Yeah, you should let it mature a little bit. But it sold very well. I've enjoyed it. I read a book by Christopher Hibbard, which was a 50,000-word history of England. And I thought, if you can write a 50,000-word history of England, you can certainly write a 50,000-word history of New Zealand. So I approached Penguin and said... It unfortunately came out about the same time as Michael King's.
A short history.
Yeah, and his was trumpeted widely. I got it into 49,000 words, History of New Zealand. And the number of people have come back to me, you know, a couple of court judges have rung me up and said, you know, I've read that, it's really very good, and thank you for that. I enjoyed writing it because it gave me a chance to work my way through New Zealand history as a kind of entity. I'd work my way through bits of it and pieces of it, but it gave me a chance to work through the whole thing and get it condensed into 50,000 words. When it was reviewed, there was the odd person who reviewed it and said, why hasn't he got more of this, or why hasn't he got more of that?
Yeah, I mean, but actually reviewing a book by complaining it's not the book that you would have written if you'd written the book is an old, sharp practice.
And one academic who actually said that there was nothing new in it, there was no new historical approach in it, so I wrote him a letter saying that if you look at Michael King's or Keith Sinclair's, there's nothing new or innovative about theirs. They are writing history. They are not looking to do something new or original. Yes, that's the book I think I enjoyed most of all, and it's the one I get the most pleasure out of now.
Actually, just playing on that theme a little, I did two histories, television histories, and in both of them I was obliged by the producers and a television station to give the subtext a disclaimer that it was a personal view. But do you really think there's any other kind of view of history?
No. As I say, as long as you treat the facts or the events with integrity, everybody's history is their own, really. Everybody's version of that history can be their own. But as long as you have respect for the facts and the events.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tricky business because, you know, when you read the great historians of the ancient world, they were actually all like the dark side. They were all kind of spinners in a way, sometimes 100 years or a couple of centuries after the event. And often they weren't like Tacitus. They came from a province rather than the centre of things. But in fact, it's always seemed to me that the two things about history was having a view of it and having a reason to express that view of it, knowing that there was some point in telling that story.
I think if you get the idea that you approach a history from a point of view, and there are a couple of historians in New Zealand, I think, do that. They have a point of view and then they write the history to match that point of view. That's dangerous to me.
Yep.
I look at history and I try and see what it means. And then I put it through my own feelings about what it means. But I do not start. I think the greatest historian of them all was Gibbon, of course. I mean, that is majestic prose. And he worked his way through Roman history and was surprised by a lot of things he found.
Yeah.
It, to some degree, destroyed his religion for quite a long, his religious faith for quite a long time. But that majestic prose, you know, it rolls. It's like standing on a beach and these great tsunami waves are coming at you, this thunderous, wonderful, orotund prose.
I love that idea, that working your way through the historical fact and finding things that surprise you and expressing that surprise. To me, that's the delight of history and historians, is when their discoveries obviously give them some kind of... Dare I use that word? Passion. Mm. Say, wow.
Yes.
And history ought to be about wow,
yes.
I think. It should not be the dull prose of dull chronology that this event followed that Act of Parliament.
Yes. I think I'm actually rewriting The Passionless People, or what I'm doing is I'm kind of looking at it and then talking about discussing it in another book. And there have been several revelations to me. The changes in New Zealand culture since 1976 have been colossal, but they're mainly material changes. As I look at it, I find things, for example, we've got this huge influx of Asians, people from ethnic backgrounds different from ours. But in fact, they've made very little impact on New Zealand culture. They're not organised. They don't organise their opinion. If they've made any difference at all, it may be in the schools. For example, my grandson plays cricket. He's 11, and I go and have a look at him playing cricket every now and again. There are two Indian boys in his cricket team. And I said, imagine that in 10 years in New Zealand, there'll be a substantial number of, because they're mad on cricket, Indian boys in the New Zealand cricket team, and they will make a difference to New Zealand cricket, ultimately. At the moment, they are having very little impact. The only real impact on New Zealand culture, it seems to me at the moment, continues to be Maori. And that only started really in the 1970s.
Yes, yeah.
And that's accelerated and accelerated and accelerated. But that's the main, that and perhaps some Pacific Island input, is the main cultural impact on New Zealand since 1976, despite all the material gains that
I think your data is absolutely right, because up to that point we were living parallel histories and parallel societies. It's only at that point when the inevitable impacts each on each made a different thing, not different things. And I kind of think that coming to terms with that is probably the biggest historical task that our generation has.
Yes, it is.
You
remember well in the 1970s that Maori were regarded, the militant Maori, most of whom we know quite well now, ordinary citizens of New Zealand, were regarded as extreme radicals. And it wasn't until they, and they're very politically shrewd, and they have had a huge impact on New Zealand culture, much more than they did in the first 100 years of since the Treaty of Waitangi. They've had a huge impact in the last 30 or 40 years. Yeah.
Can I just jump in there and ask you your response to this? Because it's always seemed to me that the committee approach to that was the attempt to neutralise that was called biculturalism, inventing biculturalism as a kind of stopper to keep on that bottle.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that's a fair assessment of that?
Well, in a sense it is, I think. Yes, I think it. I think before the 1970s, we were a white Pākehā society, very distinctive, mainly Scottish, a little bit of English, a little bit of Irish, not nearly as much Irish as Australia, but we were a very Anglo-Saxon country and culture, and that was half the problem, I might add.
Yep.
Since 1970, we have become multicultural. But the biggest impact on our society has been from Maori and maybe Pacific Islanders. In the future, I think the ethnic Chinese, the ethnic Indians are going to have a major impact on us, and I think it will be a very positive one. But in the meantime, New Zealand is culturally very much the same as it was in the 1970s. Except in one way, it's deteriorated. In the terms of literature, let me put it this way. There are lots of writers in New Zealand at the moment. There are large numbers of them, very good writers, very successful writers. But there's something gone out of the what was it James K. Baxter said? That, you have to. There's got to be a certain amount of rebellion in art and in literature. I find that too much New Zealand fiction, for example, today is preoccupied with middle-class angst. There are very few people writing about the things that Fairbairn wrote about, that Glover wrote about, and that Baxter wrote about. They were aggravating. They were irritants. They were keeping the politicians to task all the time. How many writers in New Zealand are doing that now? Yep. Not very many. And I wonder, I'll be hated for this, I wonder if it's because they've become over-patronised, there's too much money going to them, it's too easy, there are too many prizes. I hate to say that, but I have a sneaking suspicion that it is an element.
What is that Australian poet who he said, walk by the waters of Babylon, I met a public works official who said, a culture totally Babylonian has been... Down by the river of Babylon, I heard a public works official say, a culture that is truly Babylonian has been ordered for delivery today.
Yes.
And he goes on to talk about how that was smoothed and washed over by doses of money. And I think in a sense that the committeeization of arts subvention in New Zealand is very much a part of what you're talking about. It's very hard to break free of that comfort and say, no, you're stupid, or no, well, look, hey, we're wrong about this.
The publisher that approached me to do The Passionless People again, and The Passionless People Revisited, applied to Creative, without my knowing it, applied to Creative New Zealand to get a publishing grant, and the response was that it was too journalistic. And this really amused me. I mean, I don't care, but it really amused me because, you know, was Austin Mitchell's book not journalistic? Is a lot of nonfiction not journalistic in its approach or as journalistic?
Well, what does that mean anyway?
That's right, I don't know. But it became a sort of, it's become a kind of attacking slogan for The Passionless
People. Yeah, I mean, the point is that more of our books be journalists in the sense that it's a journal, it's an account of reality.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're kind of lacking. We're lacking the honest perception of who and where we are, and more to the point, we're lacking the honest perception of what is wrong with who and where we are.
Well, as Baxter said, the big danger, I mean, Fairbairn actively campaigned against money for writers. He said that Frank Sargeson should not have accepted money from the government, which I think is going too far. But I think it was Baxter who said that I can't remember the exact phrase, saying there, but he finished up by saying, otherwise you become a species of public servant. And I fear that even really good writers, some really talented writers, do not look at society. They're not looking at the way we live. Mm. And there's no morality in them. If you read Sargeson, the interesting thing about Frank Sargeson to me, or one of the very many interesting things about Frank Sargeson, almost every story is a moral fable.
Yep.
It tells you something about life, the way it should be lived, the way it is being lived. How many New Zealand authors at the moment writing fiction or non-fiction are doing that? Not many that I can think of.
Gordon, moral fables, are you going to give up telling them anytime soon?
No, I'm very keen on moral fables. I just tend to use a shotgun rather than a pistol.
Gordon, thank you. And thank you for coming to Cultural Icons on this website.